Welcome to Voter Information, the show that looks at elections in the city, the state, and the nation. This is your election guru, Mark Brown here. Glad you could join us today. And I remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items run in Ayers, LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Alrighty? Yes. Alright, we're going to do some miscellaneous things today. And so we're going to do some profiles. Start off with this one from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, May 28, 2025. Ex-Carson mayor is back in news, if not on top. Little Al Robles has had a career with many controversies and grievances. By Gustavo Arbiano, columnist. When the world calls you Little Al, you're going to do what it takes to be seen. That's what I thought after spending an hour at the Porsche Experience Center in Carson with former Mayor Albert Robles. He's not the Albert Robles who was found guilty 19 years ago of fleecing Southgate out of $20 million as treasurer. That's Big Al Robles. Little Al is the one who has tried to be a political somebody in L.A. County for more than 30 years, only to almost always fall short, his career careening from one controversy to another. In 2006, he was the attorney for three men who moved to Vernon in an attempt to take over the city council. They all lost. That same year, Little Al represented Big Al, no, they're actually not related, at the latter's sentencing and argued that his client deserved leniency since what he did was common in California politics. The presiding judge replied, "What you have just said is among the most absurd things I have ever heard." The year after he was elected Carson's mayor in 2015, the Fair Political Practices Commission fined Robles $12,000 to resolve allegations of campaign finance law violations. 2 years after that, Robles' 24-year tenure on the Board of Directors for Water Replenishment District of Southern California, an obscure agency that provides water for 44 cities in LA County, ended after a Supreme Court judge ruled he couldn't hold that seat at the same time that he was serving as mayor. He lost the mayoral seat in the 2020 general election after striking out in his bid for county supervisor in the primary that year. Robles has been unsuccessful in two other races, for an LA County Superior Court seat in 2022 and a state Senate primary last year in which he garnered just 8.5% of the vote. "I keep thinking I'm done and then I'm not done," the 56-year-old joked at one point in our conversation as Caymans and Carreras roared through the test track as we lounged in a nearby patio. "It's kind of like they dragged me back in." We met to talk about his latest waltz with the headlines. He is the lawyer for former Huntington Park councilmember Esmeralda Castillo. She's suing the city to get her seat back after an internal investigation found Castillo wasn't a resident of the Southeast LA suburb. The council declared the seat vacant and then picked a replacement. Whether or not she lives in Huntington Park, whether or not she's an angel, whether or not she's Charles Manson, that doesn't matter. "She was denied the process that all of us are entitled to," Robles said. Manson? He's also representing another former Huntington Park council member, Valentinian Amusquita, in another lawsuit against the city. That one demands the city hold a special election for Castillo's former seat, which Amusquita unsuccessfully applied for. Wait, aren't the lawsuits contradicting each other? A judge told him the same thing. Robles admitted. He told me he filed them to expose what he described as Huntington Park's hypocrisy for supposedly following the city charter over the Castillo matter, but ignoring it when choosing her replacement. "It's just like what's happening at the federal level, as far as I see it," Robles grumbled. Earlier, he compared the lack of due process Castillo allegedly faced to Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Salvadorian national illegally deported by the Trump administration to his home country. "It's frustrating." The more he talked, the more it became evident Robles wanted to be seen as the crusader he's always imagined himself to be and is annoyed that he's not. His grievances are many. He continues to hold a grudge against former LA District Attorney Steve Cooley, whom he described as corrupt, and I'll call him that to his face. Cooley, for his part, told the Times in 2013 When Robles unsuccessfully ran against him in 2008, he was probably the most unqualified candidate ever because of his political past. Robles bragged that he torpedoed Cooley's career. It's an exaggeration, over-embellishment on my part, but I actually take credit for Cooley losing his 2010 bid to become California Attorney General. Because when I ran against him, I caused him to spend money, money that he otherwise would have had for the AG race. And if Cooley had that additional $500,000 that he had to spend for the DA race, he may have won. He thinks Latino politicians need to close ranks like he feels other ethnicities do. Case in point, Operation Dirty Pond, an LA County District Attorney's probe into a long-delayed Huntington Park aquatic park. In February, investigators raided City Hall and the homes of seven individuals, including two former council members and two current ones. Robles said the probe doesn't make sense and is further proof that Latino politicians are held to a higher standard than other politicians. If Esmeralda were black or Asian or hell, dare I say even white, I think it would be reported differently. I honestly believe that, because those communities are willing to set aside their differences for the better good, because they know that, hey, if one person is being mistreated, we all are. Once I realized I wanted to discuss his own political travails as much as his clients, Robles said the better setting for our chat would have been the Albert Robles Center, a water treatment center in Pico Rivera that opened in 2019. That structure, you know, everyone loves it now. Everyone celebrates that it's there. But surprise, surprise, not one environmental group, not one came out and supported our effort to build it up. Nobody fought more for that building, for that project, than me. This set off more grievances. Robles was bitter that LA's Latino power elite hadn't listened to him and invested more time and effort in the South Bay, where Latinos make up a majority of the population in many cities, but have little political representation. They just see us as different, and the resources to organize and build up the political power base never materialized, he said. I don't know if they see it as, oh, those are more affluent communities, they don't need our help, I don't know. He was also disheartened by black residents who opposed district elections in Carson that would have probably brought more Latinos onto the council. District elections were introduced in 2020 after a lawsuit alleged Latino voters were disenfranchised in the city. Since then, there hasn't been a Latino elected to the city council. We would have members of the African American community come up and say, well, we have a Latino mayor, we don't need districts. Latinos should vote, stop speaking Spanish, and learn to vote. And then I would say, you know, everything you're saying is what whites said about blacks in the South, and they're like, that's not true. So, like, some forgot their history, and now we seem to have fallen into the politics of, if it is not us, it can't be them. We climbed upstairs to the Porsche Experience Center's viewing deck so Robles could pose for photos. Workers at the venue's restaurant greeted him, drawing the first genuine smiles Robles has flashed all afternoon. He then mentioned that somewhere in the building was his name. I thought it would be on a plaque commemorating the debut of the Porsche Experience Center in 2016, when Robles was mayor, but it turned out to be his John Hancock alongside a bunch of others on a whiteboard in a room facing the parking lot. The room was locked. Robles wondered out loud whether he should ask the staff to open it so we could take a better look. Instead, we peered through a window. It's right there, he told me, trying to describe where exactly it was among the other signatures. Well, you're not familiar with it, so you probably can't see it. He could. That was Ex-Carson Mayor is Back in News, If Not on Top, by Gustavo Arellano, columnist, from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, May 28, 2025. All right, here's another one from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, June 26, 2025. A coffee can keeps Pasadena's mayor grounded. It's a reminder of his folks' undocumented past. He knows how other people feel now. By Steve Lopez, columnist. Pasadena Mayor Victor Gordo took a break on a warm day, wiped his brow, and pointed out that the Folgers coffee can in the corner of his office. He's told the story many times, but felt it was worth repeating given recent events. For years, Gordo's parents were undocumented. They crossed the border from Zacatecas, Mexico, when he was a young child, settled in Pasadena, and raised the family. Gordo's father was a dishwasher and cook. His mother was a seamstress at a factory that used to be across from City Hall. The family lived in a converted garage. Under my parents' bed was a Folgers coffee can, and in that can was cash, a list of names and phone numbers, copies of birth certificates, and identification cards, said Gordo, who was the oldest child and described himself as a latchkey kid. If my parents didn't come home, I was to take that can and go knock on the neighbor's house and get help, Gordo said. The can in his office isn't the original. It's a replica and a reminder. With federal raids across Southern California, families and neighborhoods have been reeling. People have been afraid to leave the house following arrests at car washes, building supply centers, restaurants, LA's garment district, and street vending locations. Gordo knows how they feel. We live in fear, and that's what's so offensive about this, and painful, frankly, he said. In Pasadena, Gordo said, it hasn't been clear whether the sweeps are being conducted by legit federal agents or vigilantes. Their cars are unmarked. Their faces are shielded. Their uniforms don't answer any questions. In recent days, a man exited a vehicle in Pasadena and pointed a gun in the direction of protesters before speeding away, emergency lights flashing. At a bus stop, several men were detained, some of whom were on the way to work on construction sites in the post-fire rebuilding of Altadena, according to Gordo. And the city canceled some swimming and other recreational programs Saturday amid fears of increased federal enforcement activity. Gordo told the Times that masked men with guns and vests had chased several men at Villa Park. They're creating volatile, dangerous situations, Gordo told me, saying he fears that bullets will fly through neighborhoods or that police will arrive on scene and not know what's what or who's who. Even people with legal status are wary, Gordo said, because some of the raids appear to be arbitrary and indiscriminate. As my colleague Rachel Oranga reported, the majority of those arrested in the first 10 days of June in Southern California had no criminal records, despite Trump's vow to reel in the worst of the worst. I'm carrying my passport with me, Gordo said. The overreach is stigmatizing an entire swath of our society. Whether you look or sound like an immigrant, in the eyes of others, you are automatically considered an outsider, and that's morally and legally wrong. Gordo's positions on immigration enforcement haven't always gotten straight A's from immigrant rights advocates. In 2017, LA Progressive said Gordo's coffee can story was compelling, but accused the then councilman of waffling on a proposed city ordinance prohibiting police contacts with any federal law enforcement agencies. The article said Gordo was opposed to local police having contacts with ICE, but said on one occasion that he favored an exception for bad guys. Gordo ultimately voted in favor of that ordinance, which passed unanimously, and told me he feels now as he did then. The vast majority of undocumented immigrants are here to work hard and create opportunities for their families, he said. Same as his family. But there have to be consequences for bad actors, he added, and that's a criminal justice matter, not an immigration issue. If the federal government or our own police believe there is someone who has violated the law, they should address that issue, Gordon said. But they should do it respecting the Constitution of the United States, and what the federal government is doing now is missing due process. Also missing, says Gordo, is any conversation about immigration reform that would serve the needs of employers and give immigrants a pathway to making even greater contributions. He recalled that when he was about 10, his family moved back to Mexico temporarily as part of the process of establishing legal status in the U.S., which was made possible under the Carter administration. His father is a U.S. citizen, as was his late mother. Gordo and his sibling became attorneys, another is a doctor, and yet another is an educator. Now, said Gordo, there's no path to legalization. There's just this hypocritical system in which there is demand for immigrant labor in many industries, along with demonization of these very contributors. Pablo Alvarado, a Pasadena resident and executive director of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, told me he's had differences with Gordo over the years. but thinks the events of the last month have prompted the mayor to more fully embrace his immigrant identity. "He's stepping up to the moment, and I'm very proud of what he's doing," said Alvarado, who has joined Gordo at vigils and demonstrations. "It's one thing to tell the story of where you came from, and another thing to confront the powers behind these unlawful ICE operations. I think he's been fearless." Gordo told me he visited the Metropolitan Detention Center in downtown Los Angeles on June 18 with Representative Judy Chu, Democrat of Monterey Park, and State Senator Sasha Renee Perez, Democrat of Alhambra, to check on the arrestees. They were denied entry, but Gordo met a distraught woman from Pomona who was not allowed to deliver heart medication to her husband. Gordo offered his services as an attorney and was allowed entry along with the woman. He later learned that the husband had been arrested during his lunch break on a landscaping job, had been in the country 22 years with no criminal record, and was in the process of obtaining a green card. Gordo said that when he and the woman entered the detention center, the husband and wife were separated by a glass partition. "She was crying and shaking," Gordo said. He was telling her it was all going to be okay. He was comforting her, trying to smile. The partition had a small opening. They couldn't fit their hands through it, but Gordo watched as the pair hooked their pinky fingers. All she could muster was, "I told you," Gordo said. "I told you not to go to work." That was "A Coffee Can Keeps Pasadena's Mayor Grounded" by Steve Lopez, columnist, from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, June 26, 2025. All right, now here's this one from the Sunday section of the Los Angeles Times, Sunday, June 29, 2025. "In His Hometown, Too, Obergefell is a Hero" by Kevin Rector, reporting from Put-in-Bay, Ohio. Nearly 10 years after he changed the lives of every queer person in America, Jim Obergefell sat in a crowded bar on a small island in Lake Erie, watching the close-knit local community celebrate its third annual Pride. Jim 58 made history as the lead plaintiff in the landmark legal case Obergefell v. Hodges, in which the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on June 26, 2015, that same-sex couples nationwide have a constitutional right to marry. The last decade has diminished the familiarity of his face, once everywhere on cable news, and he appeared to sit anonymously now, sipping a beer in a booth. But Jim's legacy still resonates deeply with the LGBTQ plus people all over the country, in both red and blue states, and in little purplish outposts like Put-in-Bay too, as Molly Kearney, the queer comedian on stage, would soon make clear. Kearney spent years working at island bars and restaurants before making it big and landing a gig as the first non-binary cast member of Saturday Night Live. They are something of a legend on the island about 3 miles off the Ohio coast, and the crowd was loving their set, which was chock full of stories about getting drunk at local watering holes and navigating life and family as a young queer person. Then Kearney brought up Jim's case. The day the Supreme Court issued its decision, Kearney was working at a restaurant called The Forge alongside co-owner Mark Wright, who was gay and one of the organizers of Put-in-Bay Pride. Wright immediately told the LGBTQ plus staff their work day was done. "I just remember that day so vividly," Kearney said. He's like, "All right, all the straight people have work. All the gay people leave work. We're going out on the town." The crowd erupted in laughter and cheers and in apparent approval for Wright, the MC who had just introduced Kearney. "It was awesome," Kearney said, recalling how the whole town seemed to come together to celebrate. "It was a magnificent day." Jim, caught off guard, was also clearly tickled as he quietly took in the many smiling faces around him. A lot of people have told him over the last decade how much his case transformed their lives. Many have cried upon meeting him. Some have said his victory gave them the courage to come out to their families and friends, and even to themselves. One told him she was preparing to take her own life until his win. Still, Kearney's story might be his new favorite, he said. "For starters, it was darn funny," he said. "But it also was rooted in queer acceptance in a small community, not unlike the coastal town, a short ferry ride away, Sandusky, Ohio, where Jim grew up and now lives again. It captured something Jim has observed in his own life the last few years in Ohio, something that might be his greatest legacy, especially in light of recent political efforts to push LGBTQ+ rights backward and queer people back into the closet. Kearney's story captured people in an average, not especially progressive American community, not just accepting their queer neighbors and friends, but celebrating their right to love. The night before the comedy show, Jim was in Sandusky hosting a dinner party in his well-appointed and art-adorned apartment with about a dozen of his closest friends, family, and neighbors. He served some of his own wine. He's a co-founder of Equality Vines out of Guinerville, and ordered a bunch of pizza, including a Sandusky special, sausage and sauerkraut. There was his older brother and sister-in-law, Chuck and Janice Obergfell, who recalled traveling to D.C. for the Supreme Court arguments. Their kids are also close to Jim. The minute we heard you were going to Washington, we just thought, wow, this is too cool, Janice told him. We're awfully darn proud of you, but you know that. Chuck had worked his whole life in local plants and had known a few gay men there, regularly blue-collar guys who also happened to be the friendliest people I've ever met, he said. So when Jim came out to him in the early 90s, it didn't bother him much, though he did worry about HIV/AIDS. I just told him, you're my brother, I love you, just be careful, Chuck said. Then he brought John around, said Janice, of Jim's late husband, John Arthur. And I liked John more than Jim, Chuck said with a wry smile. There were several of Jim's oldest and dearest friends, including Kay Hollick, a friend since they were 4, Judy Neth, a friend since 7th grade, Jennifer Arthur, his 1984 prom date, and Betsy Kay, a friend from the high school chorus. There were also newer friends from town, including Marcia Gray Carrington, a photographer and painter whose work adorns Jim's walls, and from Jim's gayborhood, as he called it, including neighbors Dick Reese and Jim Irvin, a married couple who briefly employed Jim as a Sandusky Segway tour guide, and Debbie Braun, a retired Los Angeles teacher who, like Jim, decided to move back to her hometown. The conversation ranged freely from Jim's personal legacy to local politics in Sandusky, which is moderate compared to the red rural towns and bigger blue cities nearby. The talk jumped to national politics and the recent attacks on the LGBTQ+ community, which have made some of them worry for Jim's safety as an icon of a movement, as his former prom date puts it. Rice and Irvin, who started dating about 17 years ago, drew laughs with a story about learning of the Supreme Court decision. Irvin was bawling, tears of joy, when he called Reese, who was driving, and immediately thought something horrible had happened. I think the house is burned down. He's wrecked the car. The dog is dead, Rice said with a chuckle. It wasn't until he pulled over that he understood the happy news. The couple had held off having a marriage ceremony because they wanted it to be real, including in the eyes of their home state, Irving said. After the ruling, they quickly made plans and married less than 8 months later, on February 6, 2016. To me, it was profound that once and for all, we could all get married, Irving said. The group talked about what kept them in or brought them to Sandusky. Family, the low cost of living, small-town friendliness. They talked about the other queer people in their lives, including some of their children. They mentioned how the only gay bar in town recently closed. In between the heavier discussions, they chatted in the warm, cheeky patterns of old friends catching up over pizza and wine. At one point, Jim and several of his girlfriends gathered in the kitchen to discuss what else? Jim's dating life. Just the week before, Jim said, he had realized he was ready to let go of John's ashes to spread them somewhere as special as John had requested, and finally ready to date again. I'm open, he said, as his girlfriend's eyes lit up. The case that landed Jim before the Supreme Court started during one of the harder points of his life, when John was dying from amyotrophic lateral cirrhosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease. The couple had been together for decades, and in July 2013, 3 months before John's death, exchanged vows in Maryland, one of the states that had recognized same-sex marriage at the time. However, Ohio refused to acknowledge that marriage, meaning that when John died, Jim would not be listed as the surviving spouse on his state death certificate. So they sued. For years after John's death and the subsequent court rulings in their favor, Jim kept busy co-writing a book, traveling the country, giving speeches, and attending pride events and LGBTQ+ fundraisers as a guest of honor. He was mourning John, too, of course, but amid so many other draws on his focus and attention, he said, "It's almost like you didn't get to do it right away," said Betsy. You had it delayed. After living in Cincinnati from 1984 to 2016, most of that time with John, Jim moved to D.C. for a few years, but missed Ohio, he said. In 2021, as the COVID pandemic raged, he found himself increasingly lonely, he said, so he decided to move back to Sandusky to be closer to his family and friends. Since then, he has been happier, rekindling old connections, making some new ones, and even running unsuccessfully for office. Betsy, a mother of nine, some queer, and a ball of energy, said it's wonderful to have Jim back in town. The one catch, she acknowledged, is the gay dating pool in Sandusky, population about 24,000, is not exactly deep. To make matters worse, Jim is hopelessly oblivious when it comes to flirting, she said. The other women in the kitchen nodded. Taking the cue, Jim went to his bedroom and returned with a small pin Betsy had given him, which read, "If you're flirting with me, please let me know, and be extremely specific. Seriously, I'm clueless." Jim looked around his apartment, in his hometown, brimming with fiercely loyal friends and family who not only love him, but want him to find love. Thanks in part to him, it was a scene that lucky, happy, queer people might find familiar nationwide. Shortly after Kearney said at Put in Bay Pride, Kristen Vogel Campbell, a 45-year-old bisexual educator from nearby Port Sinton, approached Jim at his booth. Her friend had just pointed Jim out, told her who he was, and she just had to thank him. "You've done so much for our community," she said. "You put yourself out there. You did the work that was needed to get the job done." Jim, not anonymous after all, smiled and thanked her. A few moments later, Kearney came through the crowd, high-fiving and hugging old friends. When they too were told who Jim was, their jaw dropped. "Are you serious? Hold on." Kearney ran over and grabbed Wright out of another conversation and explained who Jim was. Wright's eyes went wide. Then he reached out and touched Jim on the chest, as if to verify he was real. Kearney, sticking their arms up to show goosebumps, said, "I have the chillies." Kearney doesn't often include the story of the Supreme Court ruling in their sets, they said, but thought the local crowd would get a kick out of it because they knew that day had meant a lot to so many people. "That day, thanks to you, was a very big day for me," Kearney told Jim. "I didn't feel fully comfortable, I still don't, so that day was really important because everyone was, like, cheering." Wright nodded along. He first came to Put in Bay from Cleveland when he was 21, or a baby gay, as he put it. And initially, it was intimidating. "It's easy to feel like an outcast in a small community because you're living in a fishbowl," he said. Soon enough, the town made him one of their own. People on the island knew I was gay before I knew, and everyone was like, "Yeah, it's okay," Wright said. He said such acceptance, which has only grown on the island since, is thanks to pioneers like Jim and like Kearney, who owns success and has increased understanding of non-binary people. "Just that while they go out and live their lives so unapologetically, it's so validating," Wright said. Introducing Kearney that afternoon, Wright had thanked the crowd, many of them locals, for proving that Put in Bay stands for love and equality, especially at such a difficult time for the LGBTQ+ community. "Put in Bay is for everyone, one island, one family," he said. Now, as Jim praised the event, saying it was just the sort of thing that's needed in small towns all across the country, Wright beamed. That was In His Hometown 2, Obergefell is a Hero, by Kevin Rector, reporting from Put in Bay, Ohio, from the Los Angeles Times for Sunday, June 29th, 2025. It said that he did run for political office and he didn't win. To be more specific, he was the Democratic nominee for the Ohio legislature in the 89th district back in 2022. All right, here's this one from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Friday, July 4th, 2025, where MAGA finally crossed the line. If voters can stand up to red hats here in Huntington Beach, they can anywhere. by Gustavo Arellano. There are such crazy times that when I found myself desperate to cover some good news amid deportations and Trump overreach, I visited Huntington Beach, MAGA by the Sea, the Orange County city that once elected MMA legend Tito Ortiz to its governing body, which currently includes guys named Chad and Butch, where Mayor Pat Burns presides over a council meetings with a small white bust of Donald Trump in front of him? The Coastal Committee that's been a hotbed for neo-Nazi activity for decades, whose factory setting is whiny gringo rage, whose former city attorney Michael Gates sued California to keep out of his hometown everything from sanctuary state policies to affordable housing mandates, and is now a deputy U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, which is likely putting a butcher in charge of a vegan picnic? Can that Huntington Beach teach the rest of us a thing or 30, not just about how to stand up to a despotism, but how to beat it back? Yep. Last month, Surf City voters overwhelmingly passed two ballot initiatives addressing their libraries. Measure A nixed a parent review board created by the city council that would have taken power to select children's books away from librarians. Measure B barred the privatization of the city's library system after the council had considered the idea. It was a resounding rebuke of HB's conservatives, who have steamrolled over city politics for the past 2.5 years and turned what was a 4-3 Democratic council majority 3 years ago into a 7-0 MAGA majority. Among the pet projects for the new guard was the library, which council members alleged was little better than a smut shop because the young adult section featured books about puberty and LGBTQ+ issues. Earlier this year, the council approved a plaque commemorating the library's 50th anniversary that will read, "Magical, alluring, galvanizing, adventurous." MAGA. They went too far, too fast, and it's not what people signed up for, said Oscar Rodriguez, an HB native. We were at a private residence near downtown HB that was hosting a victory party for the library measures. The line to get in stretched onto the sidewalk. A sign near the door proclaimed, "Not all of us in HB wear red hats." A banner on the balcony of the two-story home screamed, "Protect our kids from Chad," referring to City Councilmember Chad Williams, who bankrolled much ridiculed Protect Children from Porn signs against Measures A and B. "Look, Huntington Beach is very conservative, very MAGA, always will be," Rodriguez continued. "We stood in the kitchen as people loaded their plates with salad and pizza. Canvas bags emblazoned with Protect HB and the Huntington Beach Pier, the logo for the coalition that pushed for the measures, hung from many shoulders. But people of all politics were finally disgusted and did something together to stand up. On election night, I was jumping up and down because it was happening here," said former councilmember Natalie Moser, who lost her re-election bid last year and volunteered for Protect HB. "It creates joy and enthusiasm, and I hope others can see what we did and take hope." There was no chatter about the ICE raids that were terrorizing swaths of Southern California. A Spotify mix blared "Don't Fear the Reaper," AC/DC, and the ever-annoying "Hey Soul Sister" by Train. The crowd of about 90 volunteers was mostly white and boomers, more than a few bored tans so dark that they were browner than me. We were in Huntington Beach, after all. And yet, these were the folks that fueled Protect HB's successful campaign. They leaned on social media outreach, door-knocking, rallies, and a nonpartisan message stretching the common good that was the city library. Christine Padeski and Cindy Forstoff staffed tables around the city in the lead-up to Election Day. "Time and time again, I have people come up to me say, 'We're Republican, we're Christian, we voted for this council, but they've gone too far,'" Padeski said. Forstoff, a Huntington Beach resident for 36 years, agreed. She had never participated in a political campaign before Measures A and B. "When they, politicians, take such extreme steps, people will come," she said. The Bro Rock soundtrack faded out and the program began. "My gosh, we did this," exclaimed Protect HB chair Pat Goodman, who had been checking people in at the door just a few moments earlier. "I don't think those neighbors know who we are," cracked Protect HB co-chair Kathy Ryder, hinting at the uphill battle they faced in a city where registered Republicans outnumbered Democrats. Show them you're a supporter of good government. She led everyone in the cheesy, liberty-minded chant that inspired volunteers throughout the campaign. What do we want to do? Read. How do we want to read? Free. We were in Huntington Beach, after all. The speeches lasted no more than 7 minutes total. The volunteers wanted to enjoy the brisk evening and gather around an outdoor fireplace to make s'mores and enjoy a beer or two. Besides, they deserved to revel in their accomplishment and discuss what was next, not just in Huntington Beach, but how to translate what happened there into a replicable lesson for others outside the city. The key, according to Dave Reinerson, is to accept political differences and remind everyone that what's happening in this country, whether on the Huntington Beach City Council or in the White House, isn't normal. As bad as things may seem, you can't give up, the retired systems engineer said. You have to remind people this is our country, our lives, and we need to take care of it together. Huntington Beach isn't going to turn into Berkeley anytime soon. It's one of the few California cities that has declared itself a non-sanctuary city and fully in support of Trump's immigration policies. The architect of MAGA's Huntington Beach takeover, Tony Strickland, was elected to the state Senate earlier this year. His acolyte, Councilmember Gracie Vandermark, plans to run for assembly next year. But feeling the happiness at the Protect HB dinner, even if just for an evening, was a much-needed balm at a time when it seems nothing can stop Trump. And meeting regular people like Greg and Carol Hytopoulos should inspire anyone to get involved. Married for 50 years and Surf City residents for 44, they own a water pipeline protection service and had never bothered with the city politics. But the council's plans for the library made them outraged, and this was enough, said Carol. We need to make an impact, and we couldn't just sit idly by. They outfitted one of their work trucks with large poster boards in favor of measures A and B and parked it around the city. More crucially, the couple, both Democrats, talked about the issue with their neighbors in Huntington Harbor, an exclusive neighborhood that Trump easily won in 2024. When we explained what were the stakes, they listened, Greg smiled. Carol smiled. There's a quiet majority that, when provoked, can rise up and save the day. That was Where MAGA Finally Crossed the Line by Gustavo Arellano from the California section of the Los Angeles Times for Friday, July 4, 2025. All right, with the time that we have left, let's just go over some of the big cities that are going to be having mayoral races this year, ones that are coming up. Albuquerque, New Mexico, the incumbent is Tim Keller. He's running for re-election. We go to Allentown, Pennsylvania. The incumbent is Matthew Turk. He's running for re-election. Atlanta's having a mayoral election. The incumbent is Andrew Dickens, who is running for re-election. Atlantic City, New Jersey, is having their mayoral race. The incumbent is Marty Small Sr., running for re-election there. They're also, New Jersey as a whole is having their gubernatorial race this year as well. Billings, Montana, the incumbent is Bill Cole, running for re-election. Binghamton, New York, the incumbent is Jared M. Graham, running for re-election there. Birmingham, Alabama, where the incumbent is Randall Woodfin, running for re-election. Boston, they're having their mayoral race too. The incumbent is Michelle Wu, she's running for re-election. Bozeman, Montana, the incumbent is Terry Cunningham, running for re-election. Buffalo, New York, is also having their mayoral election. The acting incumbent is Christopher Scanlon. He is eligible to run for a full term, unknown as of right now. Calumet City, Illinois, the incumbent is Thaddeus Jones, running for re-election. Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the incumbent is Tiffany O'Donnell, running for re-election there. Charlotte, North Carolina, the incumbent is Vi Lyles. She's running for re-election. Cincinnati's having their mayoral race this year. The incumbent is Aftab Puraval. They're running for re-election. Cleveland also having their mayoral election. The incumbent is Justin Bibb. They haven't announced if they're running for re-election yet, but he is eligible to run. Columbia, South Carolina. The incumbent is Daniel Rickenman. They are running for re-election. Dearborn, Michigan. The incumbent is Abdullah Hamoud, running for re-election there. Dearborn Heights, also in Michigan. The incumbent is Bill Bazzi. He is eligible to run for re-election, but unknown whether he will. Then there's Durham, North Carolina, where the incumbent is Leonardo Williams. They too are eligible to run for re-election. Unknown if they will. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Voter Information. Until next time, everybody, this is your election guru, Mark Braun, saying to you, happy voting and peace.